Well, I got an article last week from the highest paid news clipping service in the world. I don't pay him, someone else does. But I get some really good articles from him. And this is from the New York Times in August. It said, "The son of evangelical royalty turns his back and tells the tale." And it's a story of Frankie Schaefer, son of Francis Schaefer, founder of LaBrie. And it's not a pretty picture. And it's not just him. They list other people who kind of became spiritual leaders, but whose kids didn't finish well. And then as Jill and I were reflecting on it, we kind of came up with a list of people they didn't mention in the article. Almost all the names of people you have, they have kids who don't walk with God. And you kind of wonder why that happens. How do you prevent that from happening in your own life? Because if you have kids who don't walk with God, it causes lots and lots of pain. Frankie started out, even as a teen. It says here, Mr. Schaefer grew up surrounded by heady talk. You know, all these great evangelicals, theologians, people would come to the mountain retreats and talk. And as he discusses in his memoir, he was tempted by the young women who passed through it. He got one of them pregnant when he was 17 and then eventually married her. And a little later on down in the article, it talks about how he says that when he became disillusioned, he faked it the whole way. He faked it because it was easy, it was lucrative, and rather poignant to say, he felt he had no other option. "I had been homeschooled," Mr. Schaefer told me. "I had no education," I don't know how that works, "no qualifications, and I was groomed to do this stuff. What was I going to do? If two lines are forming, and one has a $10,000 honorarium to go to the Christian Booksellers Convention and keynote, and the other line is to consider your doubts and get out with nothing else to do, what are you going to do?" And the reason I mention this kind of sad illustration is he goes on to kind of dishonor God and everyone else and what he's doing now, is he had the wrong values, and that just went down the line. He was never trained in having the right values. He had great theology, but he was not trained. And in Daily Truth Base, I've been going through the book of Genesis, as a lot of you know, and one of the things that just jumps out and screams off the pages at me is the importance of training your kids, passing on not just knowledge to them, but a lifestyle of faith and trust in God. Failure to do that causes you to miss out on God's blessing and causes huge amounts of pain. That's one of the major lessons to the nation of Israel, who's coming out of Egypt. This was written for them. And as you know, it just gives like one or two chapters on creation, one chapter on the fall, a couple chapters on a thousand-year period, and then we start with these four people. So I want to kind of just do a brief overview of Genesis. And the way I did this is I didn't build it like I normally do, where I took each section and summarized it and then went up higher and higher and higher. Because too much work. I took the easy route. Instead, I sat down and kind of thought about, okay, what are the things that really stand out? What are the things that get repeated? What are the things where there's a lot of ink? What are the things that God wants us to stop and think about? And I developed some of these themes, and I would summarize Genesis, not very eloquently, but it's about sovereignty, short circuits or shortcuts, and self-control. Those are themes that kind of keep coming off the pages in the lives of these people. As most of you know, Genesis talks about four events and four people. Creation, fall, flood, Babel. Right? So if you've ever went to walk through the Bible thing, they got these hand motions. Creation, fall, flood, Babel. Right? You can usually remember those. It gets you a little Bible aerobic reading. So next time you go, creation, fall, flood, Babel. All right, so the next rest of the book, that just takes like 11, 12 chapters. The rest of the book, up to chapter 50, deals with four people. Adam was a little bit in the beginning. But then Abraham, his major son Jacob, and then his major son Joseph. And they occupy most of the narrative. Isaac's in there as well. Can't leave Isaac out. But if you wanted to pick the top four people, you go from Abe. Just a little bit about Isaac, we're going to pick up on him in the middle. And then Jacob, who becomes the name Israel, gets 12 sons and one daughter, and then Joseph. And the amazing thing is that the majority of the ink in the book of Genesis is on the guy Joseph. He's not in the line of Christ. You've got more stuff about him than anything else. And there's some great, great, great lessons to be learned from him, and we'll cover a few of them. But there's also one that's kind of hidden, which you really don't see unless you kind of take a step back and reflect on the book and say, okay, what's going on here? Now, in management circles, one of the toughest things to get leaders to do is evaluate. To look and say, okay, how are we doing? Are we getting towards our targets? What's the effect of getting to our targets having on our people? Sometimes they'll ask the first one. They rarely ask the second. So as I'm looking at this book, I'm thinking, okay, so you know, it's God working out his program, and you know, just how is that affecting people as he does that? First thing you kind of note is that God is sovereign. Now, that means a lot of different things to different people. Sovereign means you make the rules. A sovereign nation makes its own rules. A sovereign is a king. He makes the rules. He doesn't micromanage every citizen's decision. You know, tea or coffee today? Yeah. Wait a minute, the king's got his word on this. You know, he sets up the rules. And one of the rules that God has set up is he's got a plan that he's working out. And his big plan is to glorify himself. When you're God, you're allowed to do that. Charges of megalomania don't apply to God. But in his plan to glorify himself, we benefit. He blesses. He blesses people, so he looks good. And that's what he wants to do. And he blesses his people. So in order to get blessed, you have to be his people. Attacked by the fan here. So he needs to make folks his people, and that's this concept of being separate from the pagan nations around them, being separate from the world that they might have grown up in, being holy. And the basic idea behind holiness, as most of you know, is being separate. So he wants to make a group of separate people. He wants to make them obedient, and then he can bless them. Now, his plan to bless and bring himself glory is not thwarted by human frailty. Some people have kind of said, oh, Genesis is just a puff piece for the Jews, it's kind of just, you know, designed to make them look good. Well, have you ever read the book? It makes them look terrible. I mean, one of the best claims for the authenticity of the scriptures is that the people who wrote it put themselves in the worst possible light. No one would do this. And if you read any other propaganda pieces around the world, it's like there's no mention of sin. Here, there's barely mention of doing good. So it's like, you know, this has got one of its claims to truth. So people keep messing up. But the thing about God's sovereignty is his plan to bless people is not going to be thwarted by human frailty. If we goof up, we're going to lose. If we repent, we'll get back in his graces. That's part of the rules. But he is going to carry out his plan regardless. If he doesn't bless us, he's going to find someone else to bless. I'm going to jump way ahead here. But, you know, in... come on. Ruth. No. Esther. The book of Esther. It's a great line. Basically says, you know, if you don't kind of perform, God will find someone else to perform. But he's going to protect his people, carry out his plan. And one of the great things is we have the opportunity to be part of his plan. So people who fail are going to reap problems. They're going to forfeit blessings. But God will still carry out his plan. Under Roman numeral 1c, he sets the rules for blessing and cursing. He says, if you obey me, I'm going to bless you. And if you disobey me, I'm going to curse you. And as you can read the rest of it, the point I just made, you'll find someone else to bless if you're not going to follow along. We're going to see that a little later down below. So some of the rules that he said is, you know, Adam, don't eat the fruit or you'll die. Right, that's the rule. Adam ate the fruit, he died. We kind of talked about that once before. Cain, if you do what's well and master sin, you'll be accepted. If you don't, you won't be accepted and sin's going to master you. That's the way it works. Noah, build an ark, it's going to rain, and you'll get saved. Noah didn't build the ark. Maybe God would have raised up someone else. It's a really cute story of how Noah could not possibly build the ark today with all the permits and everything that's going around. It's kind of Okay, Colin. You want, haven't read it, send me an email and I'll send it to you. So, who else is left on this list? Abraham and Isaac. I just call him Abe because at one point he's Abram, another point he's Abraham, so it also takes a blessing. Separate yourself to be holy and no pagan wives. And if you do that, I'll bless you. And if you don't do that, you'll wind up getting yourself in trouble. And that's the history of the nation of Israel. When they kept themselves his people, he blessed them. Like under Solomon, things were like incredibly wonderful. But then they kind of heart went the wrong way. They intermingled. They were no longer a separate people. They adopted the habits and customs of the people that God was judging. And as a result, they got cursed. A lot of you know Genesis 15. God says to Abram, you know that your people are going to be slaves in Israel, Egypt for like 430 years. And I'm going to bring them out with great treasure. And the reason I'm going to wait that amount of time, why he told Abraham, is because the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached the full measure. So he was going to, the Canaanites, he's going to judge them for their sin. And if Israel joins in their sin, they will get judged as well. So a lot of people have read their theology into the book of Genesis. And you can almost make the scriptures say whatever you want. If you let the scriptures speak, you're going to be on target believing truth rather than a false tradition. And as the author, probably Moses, reflects back on Abraham's life at the end of Abraham dying, in Genesis chapter 26, God speaks to Isaac as the blessing gets passed on. And God is giving the summary evaluation of what was going on with Abraham's life. So if you want to know how to view Abraham, if you want to know why Abraham got blessed, let's look at what God says in retrospect. This is the Cliff Notes summary of Abraham's life. So God says in 26:3, sojourn in the land. All right, I love the word sojourn. Some people say, there are other translations of it. But sojourn, my favorite paraphrase, that would be camp. You're just passing through. And you'll see why that's significant down the road. But you are just, you know, traveling through the land. And God says, if you do that, I will be with you. God promises his presence. And the presence of God in these people's lives is intermittent for various reasons. We're not always told why. Remember when Abraham begot Ishmael? You know, God didn't speak to him for a decade or so. That's kind of one of the things that happens. But I'll be with you and I will bless you. And then he's going to elaborate on the blessing as he had throughout the book. For to you and your descendants I'll give all these lands, and I will perform, all the oath which I swore to Abraham your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heaven, same promise he gave Abraham. And I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So that is the promise he first made to Abraham. He sums up, he goes back to it. It's a nice bookend. And then we have a really significant verse, Genesis 26:5. A little question underneath that is, why did God bless? 26:5 tells us. All this stuff is going to happen because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, kept my commandments, kept my statutes, and kept my laws. What about faith? Because Abraham believed me. God didn't say that. God emphasized the importance of obedience. And remember, this is written in the Exodus generation. So they would know the importance of doing what God said. And as Abraham did what God said and waited for him to fulfill his promises, things were good. When Abraham wavered in some spots, it didn't happen. He didn't waver about the son part, but kind of wavered a little bit in terms of the promise part. So God is sovereign. He blesses. You have to be in a position to be blessed. It's that simple. So 2 and 3 are the two major points out of this. Is in light of God's sovereignty, in light of his plans to bless, two bad things can happen. We can short-circuit God's blessing, and we do that by taking unfaithful, disobedient, fleshly shortcuts to God's promises. Or we can be lacking in self-control. We fail to develop it and pass it on, and as a result, we will suffer. So we don't want to short-circuit the blessings, and we do want to develop self-control, and that's what we're going to talk about for the next 2 points. Roman numeral 2a, wait on God to give you what's best when it's best, or you won't get what's best. And that's a theme I develop frequently because it's all through the scriptures. And you wait on God, he gives you what is best. He's God, he knows what's best. And he will also give it to you when it's best. And Joel and I went to a number of estate planning seminars over the years as we start getting old and ancient and crotchety. And one of the things that they keep saying is almost all the inheritances get spent in a year. So set up a trust for your kids, because they won't have the self-control to not spend it. That's statistically valid. It's like, and as opposed to waiting, people give the kids the inheritance too early, the kids spend it, and they lose it, and then they're unhappy. So wait on God to give what's best when it's best. He really knows the timing. And the reason I cited Romans 12, 1 and 2 there is if you do what it says, you get the perfect, good, pleasing will of God. Fail to do it, you miss out on what's best. So I'm a big believer in best. You know, it's like, why take second best when you get best? Best tastes better. You know, best is more pleasing. Best doesn't give you hangovers. You know, it's like best is really the best possible way. But not getting best means you're getting something that's worse. And sometimes that is really bad for us. But people have problem waiting. You know, ever see a toddler wait for a treat? You know, they go, I have it. You know. There's this thing about teaching delayed gratification. That's what God does. Get to the last point, remember that. But people kind of can't wait. They've got to do something. So I was thinking about, all right, how do I help people who just can't wait? And Roman numeral 2b says, if you have to do something, obey. All right? What do I do while I'm waiting? How about obeying? You know, find out what God said and do it. That would be wonderful. And that way you ensure the blessing and you get, you know, with whipped cream and cherries on top. I left out Genesis 22. When Abraham obeys God and offers Isaac. Remember the son of blessing? You know, that's a classic. God responds with double blessing. He said, in blessing I will bless you. So obedience is a really good way to get blessed. Every week I get an email when I'm teaching from either Kat or Elaine asking me what I'm going to teach on, and because they arrange the songs and they try to figure out the songs. And I kind of tell them what the themes are, some of the major emphases that I'm going on. They asked me earlier before I put my sermon together. And one of the things that they frequently come back with is Trust and Obey. Now, Trust and Obey is a great song. It's got probably the most accurate theology of any song. The trouble is, I hate the tune. You know, I liked it 40 years ago when I first sung it. But nowadays, it's like, you know, I wish somebody would update it. But as we were singing it today, I'm realizing, yeah, that's really what it is. It's trust and obey. There's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. And to put it in more modern parlance, what do you not understand about no other way? What do you not understand about trust and obey? You trust that God's going to provide what's best when it's best, and you obey him and do what he told you to do. It's that simple. You know, I have another simple thing to share later, but I'll wait. So, if you have to do something, obey. And Jill and I kind of discussed the stuff I'm doing on Truth Base, and she said, I just opened my Bible this morning at 1 Samuel 15, and it's, you know, you should probably use that in your blog. I said, no, I really don't want to jump ahead of my blog so much, but my sermons, I can do it. 1 Samuel 15, 22 is when Saul gets dispossessed from being king. God blessed him, put him at the head of the nation Israel, the first king. You know, he was a tall, good-looking, mighty warrior, and, you know, everything going for him, and he had a lot of success under his belt. And then he didn't wait. He captured someone. The word from the prophet was, wait until I get there. Saul transgressed. He went and offer the sacrifice. He didn't wait like God said. And you think, well, what's so bad about that? I mean, you know, it's like he's offering God a sacrifice. You know, what's wrong? He didn't obey. And the passage says, to obey is better than sacrifice. You know, think about, as a parent, it's never happened in our family, but for real. You know, when a kid comes to you and said, well, I disobeyed, but here, I saved my allowance and I got you this little present. Gee, which would I rather have? The little present, like I need another present, or obedience? It's like a... By the way, I love all the presents you guys gave me. I was using your pot holders thinking, yeah, they should make me some more pot holders because it's been a while. All right. You know those little ones of the... All right, yeah, they're cool. But they never gave me that at the expense of obedience. And that's why God blesses us and them. So then he goes on to say, because you rejected the word of God, God rejects you. Whoa, what's going on there? Here we have the first king, picked by God, anointed, and chosen, privileged. But then they didn't obey. And what does God say? Deal off. No more blessing. And from that point on, Saul never saw Samuel again. And it's a real indication of his closeness and his relationship with God. So if you have to do something, obey. Some examples from Genesis of how people short-circuited God's blessing are listed in Roman numeral 2c. You all know Eve. She wanted security, significance, power, pleasure, possession. She took the shortcut, Satan's way. Just bite the fruit and you get it all. I think he lied. And as a result, you know, we're in the mess we're in. Cain. He was told, if you want to be accepted, do what's right. He took the shortcut to dealing with his issues, and he killed his brother. That didn't work. Lot's daughters, you might remember the story where after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, rather than waiting for God to provide, they kind of took events into their own hands and got their father drunk, and wound up fathering two nations, the Moabites and the Amorites. And if you just kind of put them into your Bible software program and see where these guys show up, snares and enemies of Israel for the rest of their days. Another little sidebar, which I didn't include in here, is one of the things I noticed as I'm going through Genesis, is God is building up all these nations through Ishmael's descendants and through Lot's daughters that become Israel's enemies. Like, how could God be doing that? Why is he prospering Israel's enemies? And if you kind of read the blog, you kind of know the answer to that one, or you can ask me at the end. I'll tell you. It's because God wasn't going to have Israel subdue their enemies by their strength. He was going to do it by his strength. So it doesn't matter how many enemies you have. It doesn't matter how big the opposition is. It doesn't matter if he's Goliath. God knows how to deal with it. Come back to Goliath a little later. What else do we have in here in our Hall of Shame? The Moabites and the Ammonites. And Judges 10:6 tells you about that they did Israel in. Sarah. All right, Sarah couldn't wait for the descendant, so she comes up with a plan to give Abraham Hagar, and we get Ishmael. And you kind of trace the line, that's the Arab world. That's, you know, eventually you get to Islam through that. Rebecca, remember, she couldn't wait for God to fulfill the promises to bless the younger son. She deceives her husband and loses her son Jacob, as well as causing huge amounts of family grief. Jacob went along with the plot, and he encountered trouble with Laban, his deceptive father-in-law. And if you read the blog, you also know that when Jacob is facing Esau returning, he is having a full-scale panic attack. You know, no amount of lithium in the world was going to save him from this. He is really freaking out. But the thing that's amazing is you look at it, you think, wait a minute, this guy had just had a vision of angels going up and down to heaven. God appeared to him multiple times. He spent a whole day before this rolling around with God in the dirt, you know, the wrestling with God stuff. How could he not be trusting God? So why was he afraid of Esau? You know, David facing Goliath said, no sweat. And Esau was a whole lot smaller, maybe a little hairier. But, you know, why is he freaking out? And then I started going back and looking again at the character of Jacob. And the guy was really accomplished. He was a hard worker. He really was a self-made man. And he probably didn't depend that much on God on a daily basis. He kind of just, you know, had all this experience with God, but it didn't translate into his life. So when he's actually put to the test with something that is bigger than him, that goes outside his resources, the guy freaks. And he also kind of missed out on a lot of blessings to the land when he was away. Rachel, this, you know, create that wife of Jacob, who became Israel, has problems with fertility, jealousy with her sister, and she comes up with plans just like Rebecca did. It causes all kinds of family friction, which eventually results in, the long run, Joseph being sold into slavery. You kind of trace that friction through. So all these people took shortcuts to God's blessings. They weren't really heading in a really bad direction, but just getting a sense of all the friction that exists in the book of Genesis, all the family friction came as a result of people not waiting for God to fulfill his promises. God didn't say, go figure out a way to get kids on your own. God said, wait, I will give it. And we're going to see later, number four, is none of these people actually received the promises, because the lesson is you have to wait for God to fulfill it. And it's really a good lesson to learn. However, to wait, you need this little characteristic called self-control. You have a desire, you want immediate gratification, and if you jump the gun, you will get pain. It's like a person, you know, trying to run in a marathon or whatever, they think, wait a minute, I have to cross the finish line. I'll just go over there, you know, forget about running through all the burrows and everywhere. I'll just go to the finish line, I'll cross it. The shortcut, it sounds good, but the shortcut results in a lack of blessing and instead pain as you're kind of kicked out from the league. So we cause our own pain and suffering. And it's important that we eventually come to recognize that. Our first indication or inclination is to blame God. And God's not the one that's at fault. We are. But God didn't meet my timetable. Well, don't you think God knows a little bit better what the perfect timing is? He's able to provide what's best when it's best. And when we fail to wait, we are basically being a little toddler. I gotta have it, I gotta have it now. And God's there saying, why? It's not best for you now. I've got other things for you. So we cause our own pain. And by the way, pain and suffering goes to those around us by failing to develop and pass on self-control. Parents, this is a message to us. We need to have it in our own lives or we can't pass it on to our kids. And single folks, disciple-making is basically about passing on a lifestyle of self-denial, which is self-control, teaching it to others who will teach others also. So it's good for whatever ails us. So there are a couple ways of developing self-control. There are a couple outlines on truthbase.net that will give you much more than I'll be able to say here. A lot of people think self-control is willpower. And if you have willpower, it's good. You know, if you just say, I'm going to do this, and you do it, that's good. It's wonderful. Keeps you out of trouble. But I know in a number of people that have lots of willpower, but very little self-control. Self-control is where the inner core of your being desires and values the right thing rather than the wrong thing. And when we were raising our children, we focused a lot more on their heart attitude, their values, rather than the external stuff. And you can train a monkey to do the external stuff, but you can't train the heart of a monkey. You need to train the heart of children. And we also need to train our own heart. So under Roman numeral 3a, transforming our values or desires from temporal gratification to eternal gratification results in both temporal and eternal joy, even in the midst of trials. If you can kind of go through this renewing of your mind, your will, your emotions by the truth, all of Romans 12:1-2, then regardless of what happens, life is good. It's all good. And that's a lesson that I think comes through really clear in Genesis. The first spot you see it is Genesis 4:7. Remember, this is the only revelation from God, other than don't kill Abel, for 1,000 years. So I'm sure God was saying something. But you basically remember you had a quiet time back then. It was really simple. Look at chapter 1, don't eat the fruit. Look at chapter 2. And then you look at chapter 4, you know, don't kill Abel. Yeah, that's good, all right? Oh, yeah, there's another thing in chapter 4. Yeah, what's that? It's, oh, yeah, I need to master sin or it will master us. If I want to be accepted by God, I need to do what's right. Maybe that's a two-parter in there. And this is something that, by and large, in the evangelical community, nobody talks about, or they say the exact opposite. Oh, God loves you and accepts you and think you're wonderful, particularly when you're sinning, killing your brother, causing all kinds of grief. No, we're supposed to accept one another as God has accepted us. Has God accepted us? On His terms. And if we want to be accepted by Him, we have to do what is right. Notice there's no real mention of faith there. Now, I'm a big believer in faith. I mean, faith is huge. It's believing what God has revealed. And if God reveals, master sin, or it will master you, I believe that. And if you don't train yourself to have the right values, the wrong values will kill you. This is why I did a series, and which I refer to every couple months or so, on deadly desires. They will kill you unless you kill them. And you don't have to totally kill them, you just have to kind of transform them into something far better. So I'm reflecting a little bit on Joseph, because he shows up so much. And the thing that amazes me is there's almost nothing told us about Joseph's spiritual life. Nothing. It's not until his kids get named that you get the slightest glimmer of what was going on in his life. And the way his life starts out is he gets these two visions or dreams from God. And then through the book, the narrative, the comment on him is, God's prospering him. Everybody knows that God's prospering him. It's really obvious that God's prospering him. But Joseph isn't really giving us any insight into what's going on in his spiritual life. But one of the things you can surmise from what's going on is Joseph never got bitter. Unjust treatment? No problem. And I'm looking at, okay, God expects us to be able to figure out this with the data that we've got. So what's the data that we've got? I've got two dreams, and then he names his two kids. And so the two kids don't come to the end. What about these two dreams? These two dreams, the revelation from God, were his problem. And he believed it. He acted on it. He told people about it. And then all the problems unfolded. So the moral of the story is don't believe God and take action on His word or you'll get in trouble. Or you could look at that, believe God, take action on His word. And if you are in trouble, you get to claim the first of the Abrahamic promises, I will be with you. Because we are told by the narrator, which is like Moses, that God was with him. God was with Joseph. God prospered him. It's all about God being with him. And he was able to say, this is what God had promised. I will wait for God to bring that about. And in the meantime, I got better stuff to do with my time. We'll look at that in the next Roman numeral. Right now, let's take a look at some of the guys who failed to develop self-control and pass it on, and some of the pain that they encountered. Remember Adam? How do you think he felt about losing Abel? Heartbreak. You could also throw in what happened with Adam and Eve in terms of passing on restraint, but I don't want to go there. Lot. Lots of pain. New Testament says he was a righteous guy. He's vexed in his spirit every day when he saw the wickedness of the people in Sodom. So why is he living in Sodom if it's causing him so much pain? And if you read the account in Genesis, you know that when God tells him to get out, he says, oh, I don't want to leave the city life. I mean, they don't deliver in the mountains. Can you get good Chinese up in the mountains? Really? And pizza, bagels, forget about it. You're not going to get them. And Lot kind of didn't have that self-control. It wasn't taught to him, the son of Terah the idolater. So that wasn't really Abraham's fault. Because Lot could have actually been older. But you can just say he reaped pain and problems because he liked his pleasure a little too much. Lot's wife, you know, we all know what happened to her. Because she looked back into the city, you know. Oh, we got reservations tonight. And then we got Isaac. Now, Isaac was self-indulgent, played favorites, and he raises his son, who is self-indulgent, and plays favorites. Not our current Isaac, you know what I'm talking about. And the thing that Isaac loved was venison. Oh man, you know, give me some nice roast venison, a little chestnut paste on the side, lingonberry sauce, you know, I'm in heaven. And you look at the picture that's painted of him, and we get a few personal details, and that's one of them. The guy liked his pleasure. And he didn't like the promise that God said. God said, the younger will be served by the older, or the older will serve the younger. And Isaac, in the midst of all his venison meatballs and venison stew and venison whatever, just kind of lost sight of that. And his pleasure kind of did him in. He played favorites, his wife played favorites, you know, the family was not in harmony. And as a result, there was pain, lots of pain. In fact, when Esau sees that it's displeasing to his parents to marry a foreign wife, he goes out and gets a couple more. What a brat! You know, it's like, but that would be a heartbreaker for a parent. I remember thinking, you know, I don't want kids, they're just going to break my heart. Fortunately, they haven't yet. that's kind of one of the worst pains a parent has. So, Jacob's sons lost their blessings. So, Isaac, Esau with his wives. Then you get Jacob. Jacob's name becomes Israel. He's just like Dad. He too is self-indulgent. You look at some of the little personal vignettes about him, it's like, why are you guys sitting there looking at each other? Go get some food! You know, that's what he cared about. That's what he wanted. And he did not care too much about the promises of God. Although, yeah, he was doing what he was supposed to do. We're going to see that he wasn't that bad. But his pain was caused by personal lack of self-control. He is following in the parental footsteps. Now, a huge lesson to the nation of Israel is pass on the right values to your kids. I'm going to jump ahead to Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. All right? Monotheistic creator God. All right, now what should we do? Love him with all the heart, mind, soul, and strength. Okay, great. Now what? Teach them to your kids. Pass on the biblical lifestyle or you will pain yourself. So let's take a look at what happened in his life. His first son, Reuben, sleeps with his concubine, loses the blessing. Next two sons, Simeon and Levi, slaughter people with the rape of their sister, and they lose the blessing. Then we get to son number three, I think, on the list. Number four, Judah. Now, Judah's really interesting. He actually gets highlighted in Genesis. And when I started trying to figure out why that was, got some really good insights of it. But Judah has two sons, his firstborn and a secondborn. I love the name of his firstborn, Yeah, that was a mistake. The guy was so evil that God killed him. It's amazing. You know, we know when he does, you know, the flood thing, he kind of wiped out a whole bunch of people. But here, like, God specifically comes down and says, you know, your history. And the guy's gone. We're not told how, but this guy just slaughtered him. So Judah loses his firstborn son. Why? Because he didn't train him. Also, Judah married some Canaanites. Got the bad influence. He wasn't restraining his desires. One of the paradigms that you see in the book of Genesis is, I saw, I took. And whenever you see a bad action going on, you'll see, I saw, I took. It only involves having rapes or taking foreign wives. But they see, I took. There's no filter in between. I see, I evaluated, I refrained. But no, that piece is missing in there. It's just like instinct. Animal instinct is good for animals, not good for people. So there's got to be a block between what you see and what you do. And I talk more about this in series on perception and deadly desires. Who else do we have left in here? Oh, Onan got killed. He was indulging in pleasure, and the major reason of he gets killed is because, not because of Onanism, which you can look it up if you want, but because he was failing to obey in raising up sons for his brother. Levirate law, big in the Mesopotamian thing. If your brother died not leaving any heirs, you had the responsibility of marrying his wife and giving him heirs. But Onan realized, he's my older brother. If I give him an heir, then he's going to get all the stuff. So selfish, took his pleasure with the wife, Tamar, and then left. And God killed him too. So how do you think Judah felt? Like, number one, number two, gone? You know, how do you have two bad apples? Because you didn't train them. Who comes next? Oh, you have the issue with Tamar. She winds up humiliating because Judah is thinking she's at fault and not obeying God, not recognizing that he might have been at fault. And then, of course, there's Potiphar's wife. We just threw her in because she had a good thing going. Her husband didn't do anything. Joseph did it all. She ruined the situation. So when Joseph is gone, now what's going to happen? Think about that. Her temporary pleasure now made the rest of her life. Where are you going to find another Joseph? Her husband hasn't been doing anything for years, for 10 years. Joseph has been running the whole household. Now all of a sudden, it's falling apart. And her pain was caused by her lack of self-control. I wanted to just plug into the blessings that I wasn't even doing truth-based. I'm not at this chapter yet. It comes a little next week. But in 49, Israel is dying. He blesses all of his sons, except for the first three. Reuben, you're my firstborn. You're my might. You're the beginning of my strength. You're the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. You are my firstborn son. You get all the goods. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, you're kind of also as unstable as water. You shall not excel. You're not going to get blessed. You're not going to get all the stuff because you slept with my concubine and defiled my couch. So the idea is that he was usurping the father's authority. Why? Because he couldn't control his emotions. He couldn't control his desires. Why not? Because dad didn't teach him to. Why not? Because his dad didn't teach him to. It's like this progression here. And it's a real wake-up call to fathers when you read the book of Genesis. You guys need to step up to the plate and do your job. So then he gets, okay, can't bless number one. Let's go to number two and three. Simeon and Levi, you know, you guys are just evil. You're self-willed. You know, I mean, you're even hamstringing an ox. You know, it's like that's senseless cruelty. And you guys get cursed. So, and then you're going to get scattered and you're not going to get blessed. The next guy in line is Judah. And Judah does get blessed because Judah goes through a little bit of a transformation. Well, I don't know if I have this on your outline. Judah starts out, almost out of time, starts out doing poorly, self-centered, indulgent, sons have to get killed. He did kind of have the idea of let's sell Joseph into slavery so we don't have to kill him, wasn't bad. But then when the rest of the thing plays out, he's the one who actually self-sacrifices himself. He offers himself in the place of Benjamin, and he basically undergoes a reformation in his life. And it starts with he confesses the sin. One of the things that's going on with the whole Joseph narrative, and I'm probably not going to get to it again in this series, but there's all this information about his family, and it's repeated multiple times, and as I'm editing it, I'm just like, oh, we don't need that. I'm just cutting it down. I got a really small amount. I'm thinking, wait a minute, I must have cut out something good. So I go back and look over again, saying, what's the essential information in here? And there's this line where he actually, verse 21, acknowledges his guilt, and then things start getting better. That's the turning point, when he confesses that he owns the guilt. You can't get rid of it unless you own it. He says, okay, I own it, I'm guilty, forgive me, and then life starts getting good and he gets blessed. So Roman number 4, lessons for the Exodus generation and ourselves. We need to trust, obey, depend, and faithfully wait. God wants to bless us because that's how he glorifies himself. But we have to be blessable, and we do that by being the items that are listed there. Faithful, his people. That starts it. You got to be one of his people, which modern day we do by becoming followers of Jesus Christ, accepting his forgiveness that God offers through him. Faithful, obedient, and separate, holy from the pagan worlds around us. And then God is free to bless us. Still, God allows us to reap the negative consequences of wrongdoing, so he can get us into a place of blessing. And what God is doing in the book of Genesis is he actually is rebuilding the family of Israel so they'd be a cohesive unit. And then he brings them down to Egypt to bless them. And see, while faithfully awaiting the fulfillment of God's promises, we need to avoid self-indulgence and shortcuts, maintain holiness, and so on and so. Hebrews 11, you can read on your own. All these guys did demonstrate faith, but look at the ways they did it. They offered, they obeyed, they diligently seek, obeyed, they waited. I like Rebecca's, Sarah, in verse 11. She gets into the hall of faith because she judged him faithful who had promised. You can see that faith is actually a rational thing. She counted and considered that God was faithful who had promised, and then she gets power to conceive. Now, all these folks, verse 13 says, confess that they're basically campers on this planet. And they're waiting for the city that God had promised them. And if they weren't looking forward to the promises of God, they would have returned to the way they were. Verse 16, but now they desire a better, that is a heavenly city. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. I think for the most part, God would be ashamed to be called a lot of people's God, but these guys trusted and obeyed. From a radio listener in Peoria, no, actually, it's from an internet reader in Duluth. I got this comment on Truthbase, the Daily Truthbase. They thanked me for it, and they said, and it summarizes this section pretty well. Help me understand God's character, his plan, his love on a much deeper level. Helps me cut through the layers of junk and resistance that I don't think I knew was even there, and really grasp and lay hold of God for who he is. And my encouragement to you would be, when you look at the scriptures, use that for your picture of God, not something you've heard. At the end of the day, it's really simple. I really love this because I frequently say it's really simple, and my roommate says, you use that phrase a lot. And when you see it, it's really simple. I love and honor and glorify God through my obedience to him and his revelation. And as a result, he blesses me. Now, what's hard about that? It is really simple. I go on to say, I dishonor him and sin when I disobey. And he loyally punishes me or lovingly lets me reap the consequences. Nothing could be more simple. It's so clear. Okay, questions? I got some down below if you have any particular.
Actually, when you used the metaphor analogy of taking the shortcuts by going across the finish line, it's a little bit different level of thing. If you take the shortcut in your training by not going out on a daily basis to actually make the mark, so you still think you can do the whole thing, then you end up in massive pain.
Massive pain, yes. We don't like massive pain. Yeah, that's also true. If you don't do the training, you will get pain as well.
So it's really a matter of daily denial, and that's, I think, daily denial.
Yeah, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, don't you know that everybody runs, but only one wins? Run in such a way that you can win. And the way the games were is, if you cross the finish line first, they would go back and check with all the judges, you know, and actually do that in the Olympics today. But then they would do something that they don't do in the Olympics. They would go back and check your training to make sure you completed the prescribed training. Actually, with the steroids and drug tests, they almost is the equivalent. But yeah, you do have to do the training, otherwise you don't cross the line. Definitely don't get wind.
Well, think about passing on your faith to your kids. Think about Isaac. He had Abraham, right? And Abraham, you know, should have been modeling don't know the whole story, right?
But yeah, we're not told the whole story. Abraham was obeying. Maybe he was, Abraham had a couple failures of his confidence in God's ability to trust him. He did get panic attacks, which implies that he was not faithful to wait for the fulfillment of God's promise with Hagar. So there's possibly the flaw there. And, the modern day thing is, dads are too busy doing other stuff to take care of the kids. But, anybody have other thoughts on Abraham? Yeah, Gary. Oh. Yeah, Kat. Yeah, I like that. It's always good to blame things on your wife.
One observation about Abraham, he was really good in obeying the direct commandments that God gave him. But he sometimes missed the mark a little bit when he had to exercise his own judgment. When Sarah came to him and said, hey, just take Hagar, he kind of should have realized that no, this is not the problem. The same thing when they went to Egypt and he said,
so you're my sister.
Send to my sister again. We used good judgment.
It seems like a failure of spiritual leadership, actually. Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing because these guys talked to God. They got direct revelation. I think the mate, I say my blog, my problems is they didn't have a book of Proverbs. They didn't have good parenting principles to pass on. But for some reason, it's really, really tough. Had they personal self-control, then that would have been modeled a whole lot more. Apparently, that wasn't it. In one sense, in fairness to these guys, it's a new thing, this thing about God separating a group of people that he's going to bless. And they didn't have a whole lot of others. Well, we don't know what they had. But they didn't have a whole lot of history of seeing that happen. We have no excuse. It's like clear, this is what's going to happen. The failures that result are promised just as much as the blessings. So that's what you encounter.
I have a question thought maybe on Jacob's panic attack with Esau.
Mm-hmm.
What is the other thing going on is that he's never really dealt with that guilt of deceiving Esau. So even though he does have a little bit of a track record with God, or maybe not that much of a track record, as you're saying, he's kind of a self-made man, but maybe he's got it out of things, he sees reality out of whack in light of God's filter because he's got this unresolved guilt with his brother.
Yeah, that would then resolve guilt over deceiving his brother. Is it's got to put a damper on his relationship with God because sin causes a separation between us and God, even though God is in that process intervening in his life. It was, maybe he had two things going for him. God had promised that that's the way it was going to be, and then he actually bought the birthright. So twice he had it. Then mom sees, oh no, it's not going to go the right way. She steps in, and he goes along with it. He actually was very fearful about going along with it. But he didn't have enough of a personal track record to say, no, God will cause it to happen. And the rest is a lot of pain for a lot of years. Okay, last call.
I have a question about Genesis
chapter
26, when it says, I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed. So it kind of alludes to, if Abraham obeys me, then your descendants will be blessed as well. But then I remember reading an example where even if your father is a good man and you're a bad man, you are saying you will have to deal with that. So how does that work together? And then even down where it says we cause our own pain and suffering, how does that work together?
Okay, the distinction is between the promise and the pain. God is going to work out the promise and bless the descendants as giving them the right to own the land. Actually, he gives them the land. The nation of Israel has the land. They own it forever. Genesis 15 is the spot where God makes the covenant with Abraham that he's going to give them the land to him and his descendants forever. So Israel will always own that land. And when they actually do the covenant, the way the covenants in those days is they would cut an animal in half, join hands, walk between it, and say, well, I mean, what happened to this animal happened to us if we ever break the terms of this covenant? Well, in Genesis 15, only God goes between the animal halves. Abraham's asleep under a tree. So the land is always given. That is God's promise. It will always be there. Now, he then goes on to qualify, if you want to live in the land and have the blessings of it, then you have to obey me. And when you don't do that, you're going to go into captivity, you're going to be scattered, you know, history of the Jewish people. So now we get to Ezekiel. Ezekiel, the section that you're quoting, is the sin of the father doesn't go on to the sin of the kid, right? So in one sense, God is not holding the child responsible for the sin of the parents. You're held responsible for your own sin. Now, the blessing is still there, but because you've moved outside the spot where you can get it, you don't get it. Does that make sense? So the promise is there to bless, but being able to receive it means you have to be in there. So if your parents were not blessable, you can still get blessed. If your parents were blessable and they got blessed, there's no guarantee you're going to get it. You have the right to it, but you don't have it. And the basic rule, modern day application of this, is inheritance. You know, you have the right to the inheritance, and if you basically do what you're supposed to do, you get it. But you totally overthrow the correct set of values. Your parents basically get disgusted with you. You get disinherited. But that was still your inheritance. But you just don't get it. So that's kind of how that works. You have to distinguish between the general promise that God has a plan for and the personal enjoyment of it. And what you see as you go through the scriptures is Israel rarely actually got all the blessings that God had planned for them. Very good thought. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you are a God who blesses. Thank you that you are so gracious in doing that, that you would choose to pour out your riches abundantly on a group of your creatures. Thank you that we have examples before us of what we need to do to get those blessings. Thank you that your Spirit is at work in our life, causing us to will and to do your good pleasure. I pray you'd open our eyes to do the things that you want us to do. Give us grace to wait for the fulfillment of your perfect plan, because we know that what you give is always best. I pray you bless our fellowship this afternoon. Thank you in Christ's name. Amen.